So tonight I'm going to continue with this set of talks on the 10 paramis. And tonight we're going to work on look at the third and the fourth paramis, renunciation and wisdom. And remember, these are based on having first established ourselves in generosity and virtue, the first two paramis. We're shifting in a sense from the life in the world paramis, the first two, to the life in practice. Though there's certainly a lot of overlap, and you'll see, I'll keep coming back to how these apply to our lives in the daily world, because then if this stuff doesn't apply to our life in the daily world, why are we bothering, basically, anyway? Right? So I'll start by telling you a little story. So man is climbing slowly and with some difficulty up a mountain. Finally, he reaches a small plateau with a cave and an old man sitting in front of it in a robe. The climber approaches the old man and says, "Oh, great wise man, how can I reach enlightenment?" The wise man pauses for a second, then he says, "Follow the path of renunciation." The climber pauses, looks around the plateau for a few seconds, and then he says, "Is there anyone else up here I can talk to?" It's renunciation in our culture has a very bad reputation. It's associated with scandals that supposed renunciates have been involved in. And also, it just, people think of, to hear the word renunciation and they go, that's not very fun. It's just, our culture glorifies getting everything you can and not doing anything that isn't pleasurable, which is, in some senses, quite the opposite of renunciation, though not really, as you'll see as I go along. So renunciation is the third of the paramis. And basically, the first two paramis, as I said, generosity and virtue, prepare us for this renunciation. To lead a generous and a virtuous life in our culture is difficult. It goes against the stream of how many people lead their lives. It isn't normal. Renunciation requires that you renounce something, that you let something go. And typically what you're letting go are things that are believed or were taught are the source of happiness, or, you know, simply accumulating things and seeking pleasure. And I want to emphasize it, not that owning many things and experiencing pleasure is bad or wrong. It just doesn't work as a way to real happiness. It's unsatisfactory. As soon as you decide, as soon as you form the intention to take up the meditative practice, you're faced with decisions. If you're going to sit for half an hour every morning, then you have to change your morning routine. Do not do something or get up earlier, either, which is a form of renunciation. More likely it's give up something. You know, I'm not going to read the New York Times all morning. I'm just going to take a quick glance at the front page and after I sit. You know, I mean, we make these compromises all the time that we have to make to fit this into our busy lives, because we all have busy lives. There's no one here, I suspect, that isn't busy. Being busy is looked upon as being virtuous, which, by the way, I think is a terrible idea. But that's certainly our culture's idea. Someone who's really busy must be really good, because they're so busy all the time. They must have something going for them, right? But it's just true. We get busy. So now, if we're going to get up early, because if you're like me and you like to practice early in the morning, well, now you have to make sure you go to bed early. Well, that might mean, well, you know, these friends of yours are going out or they're having a party, and you might have to say, well, no, I don't think so. I have to get up early to meditate. They may not actually say that out loud, because they'd sort of look at you like you were crazy, but you know what I mean. It's like you have to start shifting. if you want to start sitting longer retreats, which I highly recommend, by the way, if you want to start sitting longer retreats, then you have to start thinking, oh, that vacation time where I used to go sit on the beach or, you know, go hiking in the mountains for a week, whatever. Now I have to take that vacation time, or at least some of it, and direct it towards retreat instead. So I can sit for longer periods of time, go away for a weekend or a week or a month, depending on what your practice is at the moment. It's like a commitment you have to make. So you have to renounce that thing you used to do that you like doing that was so pleasurable to go sit in silence someplace for a longer period of time. And basically what this means is renunciation arises in us simply out of the understanding that practice is the most important thing. We have to give it a higher priority in our lives than it perhaps it has been up till now or is in the world of people in general. This is a quote from the Dhammapada. Remember, the Dhammapada is this collection of poetic sayings of the Buddha. The path to material gain goes one way, the way of unbinding another. Realizing this, the monk, a disciple of the awakened one, should not relish offerings, should cultivate seclusion instead. Do the opposite of what would, quote, be normally what people like to do. And the problem is, this might sound kind of like unpleasant, even difficult, but actually it isn't. It's not, once you start to get your head around the idea of renunciation, it's actually quite wonderful. The Buddha often talks about the joy of renunciation. Wow, the joy of renunciation. What a thought, huh? It's like, how does it turn? Seems like an oxymoron, right? To putting those two words together, but it's true. Because renunciation is a letting go. It's a release of things that we've come to see not as important or even useful. It's the result of right understanding, of seeing that some things that we do in our daily life don't lead towards enlightenment, but instead weigh us down and hold us back. We start letting go of those things. And also we get to let go of the weight of having to do things like everyone else. How often do we just do things because, well, that's what everybody else is doing? We get to renounce the desire to be normal, a regular person, because we're not anymore. We're choosing not to. You can renounce the artificial need to conform, the feeling that you don't measure up to that impossible standard of perfection that pervades our culture. Our whole culture is based on the idea that somehow you can have this perfect life. And then we strive to somehow live that life. Of course, to live that life, you have to get all these things. You know, the right this and the right that and many of these and da-da-da-da-da-da and so on and so on. And we can renounce that idea. What a relief to renounce the idea that we have to be perfect. Whew. And you can also renounce the idea that you can't do that. That voice in the back of our heads is always going, oh, I can't do that. I can renounce that idea that I can't do that. In the sense that I can't work towards enlightenment. That somehow or other, I'm not good enough. I'm not pure enough. I'm not holy enough. Who am I to think I should work towards enlightenment? I can renounce that idea. So we can let go of all these things. Renunciation is partly just a letting go of all these ideas that hold us back. All these mental processes that we go through all the time thinking, it gives us excuses not to practice. We're renouncing all of those excuses. Whew. Gone. On the other hand, and this is important, we have to understand that we can't force renunciation. It can easily just become another desire, you know, a desire to conform to some standard based on our religion or on our Dharma community. Oh, all these people are so serious about practice. I should be as serious as them. I should practice as much as them. Or we get this idea that I should just renounce everything. Just, that's it. I'm getting rid of everything. I'm going to Marie Kondo my entire life and just renounce everything. And that somehow that renouncing of everything, that's going to make my life great. But actually what will happen, pretty much guaranteed, if you go at this too hard, too quick, too soon, is you'll have this rude shock where the mind will literally rebel and you'll swing to the extreme of self-indulgence. I've seen this happen with people I know, close friends of mine back in the day, who were like, I'm going to be this serious or serious monk, and all of a sudden they're drinking and dancing and going crazy. I'm not that dancing is bad, by the way. Just to the extreme, they just cut loose and gave up all the practices completely. Because they went to one extreme and then they swung to the other. So you have to find this balance. And so renunciation has to be sort of a gradual process. And this gradual process of renunciation is reinforced by your practice. It's like the more you practice, the more it becomes a relief to renounce. It becomes a joy. The joy of renunciation arises the more you practice. It becomes so obvious that it's time to let that go now. It's not like a problem anymore. On retreat, if you've ever been on retreat, you know this already, but if not, on retreat, we take this idea of renunciation to a deeper level. Because basically on retreat, we renounce everything. Everything that we possibly do to distract ourselves. Talking, because it's noble silence. Reading, writing, music, our cell phone, our computer, all that stuff. We just set it aside. This is serious renouncing. This is like big time renouncing when you go on retreat. You're renouncing all the things you would normally use to distract yourself. So that all that you're left, when you're on retreat, all that's left for you to pay attention to is the contents of your own mind, which is a scary thought sometimes, right? But that's what retreat's all about. But you have to take that choice to renounce. I mean, you're not even doing things like on a regular retreat. You're not cooking. You're not shopping. You're not doing anything. You might have a little job in the kitchen for half an hour a day where you help clean up or you help chop vegetables or something. Or maybe you're the person who gets to clean the toilets, lucky you, or whatever. Everybody has a job, right? But that's it. Even on a day long, if you're just doing a daily, on an 8-hour retreat, a day long retreat, you pack a lunch in the morning before you come, and that's it. That's what you're eating for lunch today. You can't say, oh, well, no, actually, really, what I want is, you know, something else, and rush off to the store because you're on retreat. You renounced that ability to go do that stuff. I mean, basically, when you're on retreat, the only decision you have left to make is, am I going to keep practicing or am I going to go to sleep? That's it. That's your one big choice every day. Is it time to go to sleep yet? Okay, no, maybe I'll stay up and practice a bit more and then I'll go to sleep. That's like the big decision of the day. You know, maybe he's like, well, do I want to eat? You know, because the food's just there and you just take whatever's offered, you really don't even have much choice of what you're going to eat. Maybe you have a bit less of this and a bit more of that. That'd be a big decision too. Like, but other than that, life is, it's incredibly simple on retreat. And to be honest with you, this may seem kind of, the idea of it even might be a little frightening. Like, to have so little control of your life. But actually, it's incredibly liberating. You just wake up when the bell rings in the morning, or maybe even before the bell, like some crazy people like me, and you do the practice. You know, the bell rings, you go sit, the bell rings again, you go out and do some walking, the bell rings again, you come back and sit. I mean, it's really simple. I mean, the bell is telling you what to do. You don't need a watch, don't need a clock, don't need even any of that stuff. You just practice. And you start to see how all the reactive patterns that we normally have that drive the actions that we perform in the world are just thoughts in the mind. Just stuff that arises. It's there and then it's gone. We start to actually see how the mind works. That's the beauty of retreat. And this gives you the urge, the intention, to form the intention to practice more in your daily life. And this leads you to renounce even more things. It's like it's a cycle. There's a... And this is another verse from the Dhammapada. If by forsaking a limited happiness, he would see an abundance of happiness, the enlightened man would forsake the limited happiness for the sake of the abundant happiness that comes from practice. So simply put, renunciation is, I think of it as the gateway to right understanding. Like when we renounce, when we start to really consciously choose to let go of things to put more energy into our practice, it really enhances that first step in the Eightfold Path that says, this is what's important. This is what's important. Nothing else. This becomes the thing where I'm making a decision. It's like, how does that fit in with my practice? It becomes a driving force in how we make all the decisions in our life. A lot, in other words. Then we move on to wisdom. And I put a little note here in my notes. It says, wisdom, the fruit of practice. So, we've formed the intention to practice and we've actually renounced and we've practiced. Now the fruit start to arise. So wisdom, the fruit of practice. There's another verse from the Dhammapada. From practice comes wisdom. From not practicing, wisdom's end. Knowing these two courses, development or decline, conduct yourself so wisdom will grow. It's wonderful, simple advice. Huh? From practice comes wisdom. From not practicing, wisdom's end. Knowing these two courses, development or decline, conduct yourself so wisdom will grow. So wisdom is the fourth of these paramis. It arises as you develop, sort of in parallel almost with renunciation. Just the fact that you choose to renounce is an aspect of the wisdom that has already arisen. But I'd like to talk a little more in detail about wisdom, which is sometimes a misunderstood word. And basically there are, within this tradition, within this practice, there are three different kinds of wisdom, three different aspects of wisdom you might encounter. There's the wisdom that arises from study, the wisdom that arises from reflection on what has been studied, and the wisdom that arises from the meditative practice itself, actually, while we're actually in the meditative practice. And the wisdom arising from studying the Dhamma is usually called knowledge. And so now I'm starting to differentiate wisdom from knowledge. Knowledge, it's like book learning, or, you know, in this day and age, everybody listens to Dharma talks all the time. You know, there's lots of Dharma Seed fans who can't miss their daily talk, right? And I want to say that I think study is an essential part of this practice. It's really essential. And even doing this, what you're doing right now, coming, listening to Dharma talks, this is a form of study you're actually participating in right now. This is, you're studying the Dharma. It's part of how you can do that. So when I say study, I don't mean just reading. And the beauty of study is we start to get understanding, knowledge about the context of this practice, so that there you are later on actually sitting or doing walking practice or some more formal practice, and something arises. And because you have this background, this study, you go, oh, that's what that thing was talking about, or that's what he was babbling about during that Dharma talk, or whatever, you know. You have the context that gives you a clue as to, oh, you start to see it in action. It isn't just an idea in the mind anymore. It's not just something we think about. It's something you start to actually experience. But the study gives you context for something that otherwise you might miss completely, or might just be sort of confusing. So it gives you a framework, a point of reference. The problem, of course, with this sort of knowledge, this sort of wisdom knowledge, is that it's pretty much primarily mental. It's just thoughts. Just more thoughts, as a matter of fact. Skillful, useful thoughts. It's nothing wrong with thinking, but it's still just conceptual. It isn't something we know in some much deeper way. It's not something we experience. It's just something we have an idea about. So the next step in wisdom is reflection. Which is the process of looking at the knowledge you gain from study and consciously challenging it. You read something, you hear something, and you go, yes, but. You actually question and try and look at what's being said or what you read from different angles and go, how about, but what about, you know, and we start that process of examining what we've read or what we've studied for its validity in our own lives. How does this feel for me? As opposed to just, this is what was said. I should just believe it. And the Buddha, there's a famous sutta. I should have looked it up today, but I forgot. This famous sutta where these villagers come to the Buddha. The Buddha, you know, traveled all over the place, and he was always coming in, come to another village. And apparently this village had a lot of different teachers coming through town over the last while. And so the villagers were kind of confused. And they said, well, to the Buddha, how do we know who to listen to? Who should we pay attention to? And the Buddha said, well, don't base your decision on tradition. Don't base your decision on what makes sense intellectually. Don't, and he goes through this long list of all these things. And the last thing he says is, and don't make that decision based on what I said. Don't believe me. Believe what you experience from your own practice. That's the only way to truly know. Everything else is just thoughts. So that's the process of reflection. You know, and there's lots of ways to do this. Like you can just do this on your own, or perhaps you're lucky and you live with another practitioner and you can have little Dharma discussions, or you belong to a Kalyanamitta group where you get together with a group of people once every couple of weeks and have a discussion about some text that you're studying. There are, by the way, connected to I Am Insight Meditation Community of Colorado that I'm part of, there is quite a strong Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta means spiritual friends groups that get together regularly outside of this sort of thing where we, you know, someone giving a Dharma talk, their peer group meetings. And that's a very rich time to reflect on the teachings, because you get six or seven people, you get six or seven different opinions of what something means or how important it is or what's the relevance of it. And it's a good way to hear different viewpoints. The key, of course, with reflection is it has to be done with an open mind. It can't be, well, I'm going to reflect on this, but I know all of you are wrong and I'm right. That's not reflection. That's politics or something. But it's not reflection anymore. So even this form of wisdom, however, is still at the level of this discursive thought. It still needs to be integrated at the level of personal experience. And the third form of wisdom arises directly out of insights gained in meditative practice. I mean, often, you know, this practice is called insight meditation for a reason, because this form of practice creates the causes and conditions such that insights can arise. Insights into the actual nature of things. Insights into what's called the three characteristics, you know, unsatisfactoriness and permanence and not self. And this can only happen through practice. The insights arise directly out of the practice. The more you practice, the more often you practice, the deeper your practice goes over time, the more likely insights will arise. And it's these insights, all of a sudden you get a sense, you don't just believe that things are unsatisfactory. You actually see the unsatisfactoriness of everything you're experiencing. You start to see not just the content of what's arising in your mind, but the underlying patterns. For instance, you can see that all that's really happening ever is something arises, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. Whether it's a physical sensation or a thought in the mind or whatever, that's all that's ever going on. So you start to see really clearly, not as an intellectual concept, but as an experience, how everything is impermanent. Because your mind is still enough and focused enough that that's what you see happening. You see not the stories going on in the mind, but the underlying process, which is just things arising, they're there, they're gone. We start to actually get a clear understanding on this sort of ever-changing stream that we're just an expression of, in a sense. And you start to see how much of what we do has to do with either grasping and holding on to things, trying to make them permanent, or pushing them away. Desire and aversion. You know, the two poisons, two of the three poisons. Or we start to see that sometimes we're just totally spaced out. Delusion. Oh, the third one. There we go. Covered all three poisons just like that. And we start to see that, not as a concept, not as a mental plan or anything, but as like an actual experience. It's something you know at some much deeper, visceral sort of level. And I want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. And this is how mindfulness and wisdom are closely associated. The aspect of mindfulness is its close association with wisdom. This comes about through bare attention and clear comprehension. The quality of bare attention can manifest on different levels and is called different things in the various Buddhist traditions: mindfulness, naked awareness, innate wakefulness. It is naked and bare because it is simple, direct, non-interfering, and non-judging. It's not making up stories about experience. It's just simple awareness of things as they are. It's a phrase you often hear describing what meditation is all about. It's like seeing things as they really are. A bit further on, the power and strength of bare attention comes not from special experiences, but from a sustained continuity of awareness. Often we think that, you know, we've got to have some amazing experience to make our practice valid. But it's the sustained continuity of awareness. Continuity is a huge topic in this practice. Whether it's like just when you sit for half an hour trying to keep continually steady, mind steady, not letting the mind wander, remembering to keep coming back. It's not like we're trying to have any particular kind of experience. We're not trying to make the breath or the body be anything special. This is Joseph again, rather we're simply listening to, be aware of, and receiving the contact of whatever presents itself. The other aspect of mindfulness closely associated with wisdom and conducive to it is called clear comprehension. This means seeing something precisely, thoroughly from all sides. Clear comprehension broadens the practice of bare attention from a narrow focus on one to one that sees things in context. So I was talking about a little bit about, if all we're doing is paying just bare attention, then we're seeing something arise and that's gone. But if we start seeing underneath that layer of what we're actually seeing, the actual content, we start seeing the process that underlies that whole thing. That's clear comprehension. That's where we start to have deeper insights into the actual nature of the mind. It's that. So we need bare attention, but we also need clear comprehension. They go together, they're a combination. And the two of them make up what wisdom is all about, in a sense. I had on one of my long retreats, I had a pretty clear illustration of this, I suppose, an instance of this. This is, I was on a 4-week retreat, and this was like halfway through week 4. So I'd been practicing for quite intensely for a long time. And one of the things I did every day was ring the bell for the 2 o'clock sitting. it's just like everybody chooses these duties when they're on retreat, and I decided I would ring the bell. And so I just, as I had done every Tuesday for the entire retreat, I mean, every 2 o'clock, I went and I picked up the hammer, and I sort of, because I was really paying attention, I could feel the hammer in my hand, and I could feel the weight of it, and I could see the bell, and I could feel my arm moving, and my the striker hitting the bell and hearing the sound of the bell. I was just like really precise attention just to what was happening in the moment as I was actually doing this. It was like just one of those times in your practice where things were just clear. Just one thing and then the next and then the next. And then as I was hanging up the hammer, the thing that we use to strike the bell, this thought arose in my mind. And the thought was, you may never ring this bell again. And that really like struck me, like it was really just like totally crisp and clear thought. Noted that. And then my mind started worrying. And it's going, yeah, but you know, I'll be here tomorrow to ring the bell. I mean, there's still 3 days left on the retreat. And then it was like, oh, yeah, but who knows whether I'll actually ever be here in 24 hours to ring the bell for the 2 o'clock set. I didn't really know that at all. And it was like, oh, this is a lesson in impermanence. This was like, it was really clear to me that what this was like, pay attention. You think it's guaranteed that you're going to be here tomorrow to ring this bell. And you're not. You're not guaranteed at all. You don't know that. And it was like, I realized that all my study about impermanence and sort of my emotional, mental understanding of impermanence was just that. Because really what was going on was I was thinking, yeah, I'm definitely impermanent, but not for another 20 years or so. And that's not true. Absolutely wasn't true. And it was like so crystal clear to me. It was really a clear insight into the nature of impermanence and what it really meant. And that was a wisdom moment for me to actually see that so clearly. I mean, study and reflection had prepared me to see into that, for that insight to arise. But I actually had to experience it right in that moment for it to sink in on some totally other non-intellectual level. That's how wisdom arises in this practice. So there's these three forms of wisdom that I've been talking about: study, reflection, and what arises through insight during meditative practice itself. And they're all sort of connected. You know, one leads to the next in a sense. And as a dedicated practitioner, you need to work on all three. You have to find time to study. Oh, here's another thing you have to find time for, by the way, to find time to study. Then you have to find time to reflect on the meaning of what you've studied. And then you have to practice. I mean, the actual formal practice is really important. Practice, 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 practice. I want to read one other thing here about this. Mm-hmm. And this is equally important. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And this is a chapter called Wisdom and Love, which I think, what a great chapter heading. Wisdom and love are the two great wings of the Dharma. Whether we are in the swirl of a busy life or in deep silence of retreat, a clear mind and an open heart are the paramount forces we cultivate as both the means and the end of our path. Let me read that again, because I think this is quite important. Wisdom and love are the two great wings of Dharma. Whether we are in the swirl of a busy life or in the deep, still silence of retreat, a clear mind and an open heart are the paramount forces we cultivate as both the means and the end of our path. So this is the other, in a sense, aspect of wisdom, is that we understand that wisdom has its limits, that we need this balance of wisdom and what Joseph here is calling an open heart. We need this balance of insight practice and some form of heart practice, whether it be metta or compassion practice or some other form of heart practice, finding that balance between the two, to cultivate both our deep visceral understanding and also to open our, keep our hearts open and open in our hearts more and more. And these two feed off each other. When I first started doing those two forms of practice, they seemed to me, metta and vipassana, to be totally different. Over time, as I went deeper into both of them, sitting long retreats with both of them, I started to see that they were just two, like it says, like the two aspects. The image often used is like a bird, you know, has one wing of love and one wing of knowledge or wisdom. And for the bird to fly, both wings got to flap. You know, you can't have just one or just the other. You know, it's dangerous to think that I can just be this serious meditation guy, which I was there for a while, so I speak from experience. Think, oh, that meta stuff, you know, that's just like for those wishy-washy hippies, you know. This is like, I'm a serious meditator, you know. But it's that balance of the two, a balance of wisdom and love, that's really important. It gives us this whole. So generosity, virtue, and renunciation all lead to wisdom. But wisdom needs to be balanced with this open heart. And I want to finish reading from one of my favorite poets. This is excuse me. This is from Dana Fall's book, One Soul. There we go. This is called Intimate with All Things. The Buddha said, I'm intimate with all things. Imagine that, to be on the same close terms with suffering and panic as bliss and rapture. To know the souls of water buffalo as surely as my own. To push away nothing. To let the sweet or bitter taste of life linger. To see the beloved in everything. And when that isn't my experience, to be intimate with self-hatred, unmet preferences, and the many ways I don't show up as saintly. Imagine that. This is a reminder that even though the paramis are called perfections, this isn't about being perfect. It's about moving towards perfection. Practice of the paramis moves us in that direction. And that's all we can ask for. Because some days, as you all know, I'm sure, we're somewhat less than perfect. And that's just being a human being, perfectly normal. So that's all I have to say. So I'm now going to unmute you all. And as I have in the past, if you would like to speak or ask a question or share something from what you've gained over the last hour of me talking, feel free to do so. Or you can, as some people have already done, mute your mic, and that's perfectly fine as well. Don't feel like in any sense that you are obliged to speak. If you want to speak, just sort of wave. I don't want to do the formal, you know, everybody has to get in line and do stuff thing. Just if you want to speak, raise your hand and I'll say, yeah, it's your turn and you can speak and that'll be fine. Let's keep this simple. Don't feel, like I said, at all obliged to speak if you don't want to. And don't feel like there's anything like a silly comment or a bad question. Just whatever is, if that's what's on your mind now, that's what's come up, then share that. That's fine. It's really useful for me to get feedback in this way to see, oh, I didn't explain that very well, or oh, that worked, and then everybody's telling me how wonderful that part was, or what. Just feedback is very useful for someone who's a teacher. So if you're inclined.
I'm inclined, Barry.
Okay, Franny's inclined. Okay.
And it's not that you didn't teach it well. I was distracted because I was eating dinner during all of this tonight. So not really staying totally focused. But you talked about the insights that arise from practice or insights that arise out of practice. The insight of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. And what was the other one?
Not self.
Not self. Thank you.
Okay, I saw Rachel waving her hand.
I more just had a comment, unless of course you want to
comments add, are great.
Comments add are to great. It. I really liked your what you said about balancing love and wisdom, because I know that in I do restorative work. And so in some of the work that I've done, I've had this shift where I go from, oh, I know everything and not really listening to others and going into the space where you actually open your heart. And I have experienced a gain of wisdom from opening my heart and listening to others. And so that was really just very useful for me.
Oh, thank you. That's great. And it's true. It's like I think that I really like the image of the bird and two wings. Like with only one wing, the bird can't fly, and the wings help each other. You know, to turn, you have to tilt one wing one way and the other wing, you know, it's like you have to be coordinated. Otherwise, the bird doesn't fly. So, other thoughts, comments, questions?
Well, one of the things that I'm getting, and you've said it a couple times, is that these 10 paramis are sequential. Whereas when we talked about the Eightfold Path, that was more not necessarily sequential, not in order. Am I interpreting that? No? Go ahead.
Yes and no. Yes, they are sequential in the sense that that's how they're traditionally taught. But in the end, all 10 of them are running at the same time, and one gets stronger than the other. So over time, you get to see how one, they're all interrelated and they all feed into each other. But in the teaching, it's quite useful to look at them sequentially, because you can see how things develop on the path.
How based on the sequence. From one then leads to the other.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. But they are all interrelated. Like I said, as you gain more wisdom, you are just moved to renounce more. Oh, there, I just reversed the order. You know, so it's like they feed back and forth, but the in explaining them, it's quite useful to teach them in this sequential manner, which is why I do it that way. And that's typically how they're taught.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them taught. I'm just being very traditional like I usually am. So, but you're right. They are just like the Eightfold Path. They go around in a spiral. They go in circles. They all interrelate with each other.
Hi, this is Lisa here.
Yeah, hi, Lisa.
Hi. You know, I really appreciated your talk about the renunciation. I hadn't really learned too much about renunciation, so it was a little bit of a new topic to me, but I liked how you talked about how we can renounce things like negative thoughts and negative expectations, or just other regular expectations, and the idea that we have to be normal and all of that. So it wasn't just renouncing the things that we know, you know, prevent our practice or prevent our learning, but it's also these things in our heads that can be holding us back. So I really appreciated that.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad that message got through clearly. That was encouraging for me.
Yeah,
and it's when I saw that, I was like, oh, renunciation, that's the joy of renunciation that the Buddha talked about. I think it's like, now you don't have to be normal. Now you don't have to meet anybody's expectations other than your own. What a joy. So anyhow, yes. Thank you. Okay, I think it's like people have run out of steam. So perhaps we'll close. I will just do a brief dedication of merit here. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for your kind attention. I'll leave this on for a little bit if you want to chat or anything. I also, there are two chat messages here. Don't worry, I will respond to them. If you sent me a chat message, I will deal with it. And I'll see you all next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Bye.
Hi, Deborah.
Bye, good night.
Okay. Okay, that's great.